content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times and the weekend editions of the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we undertake varied explorations that involve some high-tech travel. First up, we go driving an electric car on Colorado's scenic byways. Writer Elaine Glusak's experience included questions like, will the battery hold out crossing a 10,655-foot pass? Where's the next charging station? And she learned about overcoming range anxiety on Colorado's highest mountains. Her article appeared in the June 16, 2021 issue of the New York Times. Unless you're one of the estimated 7% of Americans who own an electric vehicle, sometimes called EVs, it's pretty hard to take a scenic emissions-free road trip. But for those owners and other eco-conscious travelers who can rent an electric vehicle, and it's not always easy to find one, Colorado is inviting you to meander far from the charging stations clustered in big cities. This summer, the state has electrified 7 of its 26 scenic and historic byways, routes designated for their natural, educational, or historic features that often traverse wild areas where jaw-dropping sights make you appreciate the pavement that you got there. Charging stations can be found roughly on every 100 miles on these routes, which range from the namesake plateau and lakes around Grand Mesa to the seasonal Trail Ridge Road reaching over 12,000 feet in Rocky Mountain National Park. More than 140 fast-charging stations, plus 34 planned or available on Colorado's corridor interstates and highways, help EV drivers get to them. Given that transportation is the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in the United States, EVs are central in efforts to fight climate change. The Biden administration's infrastructure plan proposes $15 billion to build a 500,000 charging stations nationwide. California and Massachusetts will require all new cars sold in those states to be electric by 2035. Electrifying Colorado's entire byway system is a product of Governor Jared Polis' plan to make the state's electric grid free of fossil fuels by 2040. To test Colorado's new system, I drove all or parts of three of the state's electrified byways over roughly 450 miles in early June, including the Lariat Loop near Golden, about 15 miles west of downtown Denver, the top of the Rockies south of Vail, and its continuation along Collegiate Peaks south to Salida. Unlike road tripping with a combustion engine, everything about EV road tripping was, to me, a novice EV driver, a learning curve in the following lessons. Well, finding an EV isn't easy as this first lesson. The first hurdle in traveling Colorado's electric byways is finding an electric vehicle. They are scarce among major car rental companies, though by year-end, the Dollar and Thrifty rental car outlets at the Eagle County Regional Airport near Vail plan to add them. To rent an EV, I turned to Turo, the Airbnb of cars. Turo allows car owner, also called host, to rent their vehicles via the platform. Even there, EVs were not common, and I ruled out Teslas, which tended to start above $150 a day. For best results, I quickly learned, start in a city. When I moved my search from Aspen to Denver, I found Nathan's 2020 Nissan Leaf for $59 a day for my four-day adventure. Suppress your spontaneous instincts is the next lesson. After learning my plans, Nathan lived up to his all-star host status by messaging me with an online map he had created of my longest drive, showing the route mileage from Denver west to Vail, then south to Salida, and back to a website called A Better Route Planner, which included suggested charging stops. I'll pause here for a moment. Notice I said Salida. Earlier I said Salida. Both are okay. Locals call it Salida, but in Spanish it is Salida. It was an early indication that I would trade spontaneity for certainty. While gas stations are ubiquitous, allowing road trippers to improvise, the scarcity of EV charging stations dictates where you can go and how far between charges, often resulting in what EV owners call range anxiety, a condition Colorado's Byway Electrification Plan aims to combat on the rural roads. Another lesson, learn EV math and app up. I picked up Nathan's Nissan Leaf from his home near Denver International Airport. The car was charged to 100% with an estimated 230 miles on the battery. But the mileage calculation frequently shifts, as I learned over the course of the trip, affected by inclines and cold weather, both of which eat more battery charge, and replenished by hooking up to a charger and braking or driving downhill when the battery regenerates. One fellow EV driver I met in Golden even recommended turning off the air conditioning, done rather uncomfortably on an 80-degree day, to stretch my battery life. To find public charging sites, I downloaded the PlugShare app, which maps them. The slower or level 2 charges on the byways tended to be free and added about 25 miles in an hour. Direct current fast chargers, which you pay for, are more powerful and quicker, though how quick and how powerful is subject to a lot of variables, including battery size, existing battery charge, and powering speed. According to the Energy Department, it can take between 30 minutes on a fast charger and a full day on the slowest charger to fully recharge. DC fast chargers may be priced by the minute of use or the kilowatt-hour dispensed, but Electrify America, which operates such stations across the country, said the average cost of bringing a battery to 80% charge, the going rate quoted in the EV industry as the final 20% is often slowed down to preserve battery life, it runs between $16 and $20. Additionally, to use public chargers, I needed a credit card-linked account with the app ChargePoint, which unlocks the charger hoses even when the charge is free. It was often a glitchy process to get my phone to talk to the kiosk. Though I used only about 40 battery miles to reach the new Eddie Tap Room and Hotel in Golden, and which goes at $209 a night, I plugged the car in overnight at its complimentary charger, one of the amenities, including loaner bicycles for town touring and local beer on tap, that made it the ideal one-day stop for quelling range anxiety. And then the next lesson, every mile is not created equally. You could drive the 40-mile Lariat Loop from Golden into the foothills of the Rocky Mountains in about 80 minutes, but as I quickly learned, of all scenic byways, many attractions, trails, and pull-out photo ops urge you to stop, extending the ride. After hiking the 1.5-mile Ticeratops Trail in Golden to see fossilized dinosaur tracks, I continued south to Red Rocks Park and Amphitheater, a concert stage framed by 300-million-year-old sandstone monoliths. Leaving Red Rocks, the route wound beside Tumbling Bear Creek through a rock-walled canyon with continuous snaking curves that made driving the EV, which hugged the corners thanks to its low center of gravity, a joy. I have been on that same trail, but not in an EV, and everything that's described here is correct. I took my eye off the Leaf's mileage range for most of the rolling drive until the last stop atop 7,377-foot Lookout Mountain back near Golden, home to the grave of the Western showman, Buffalo Bill Cody, and views well past Denver. Over 5 miles, the road switched back in 56 curves, sending the car's computer into a mileage dive. Lookout Mountain taught me the value of a full charge when ascending, which I would have to do to reach Vail via I-70 over 10,666-foot Vail Pass. While gas-powered engines also use more energy to get up hills, drivers can relax knowing there's a gas station at nearly every interstate exit. Not so EV drivers. About 60 land miles into the trip, I had used 125 battery miles, more than twice the anticipated rate, to reach 9,000 feet at Silverthorne. Thanks to some descending, I arrived in Vail with 40% battery charge and 95 estimated miles to spare. Vail offers ample public chargers. Its buses are electric, and many hotels maintain their EV plug-ins. Mine, the trendy new Gravity House Vail, and that starts from $150 or $159 a night. They had the next best thing, free public EV chargers and a lot across the street and an overnight parking voucher included in their rate. Another lesson, charging is a lifestyle. By day three, with growing confidence in the car's battery life, I set out to string together two electrified byways, top of the Rockies and Collegiate Peaks, over about 100 miles of mountain driving, including crossing the 10,424-foot Tennessee Pass. From the funky mountain town of Minturn, behind Vail Slopes, Highway 24 slaloms between roaring rivers and snow-capped mountains. The road terraces into granite walls and vaults one canyon in such a spectacular piece of engineering that I made seven viewing stops in the first 10 miles. Reaching Leadville introduces the reason these roads flourished, mining. 70 square blocks of Victorian homes, ornate hotels, and an opera house attest to the town's boom years and silver mining in the 1880s, when 30,000 people lived in the town, now home to fewer than 3,000 residents. A self-guided walking tour visits those buildings, many filled with museums, outdoor outfitters, and artist shops, including the Harper Rose Studios and Elevation Goods. Marrying sustainability to economic development, the electrification project targeted byway towns like my next stop, Buena Vista, on the Collegiate Peaks Byway, with charging locations strategically placed to encourage drivers to patronize small businesses while waiting for their batteries to replenish. Making charging time touring time, I plugged in over lunch in view of Mount Princeton, one of the 14ers, mountains above 14,000 feet, named for Ivy League schools, and a hike on the Barbara Whipple Trail, watching rafters on the Arkansas River navigate the rapids. About an hour on the free level 2 charger gave me a 25-mile boost. Then my next lesson was embrace the slow lane. At the end of the Collegiate Peaks Byway, Salida, a 19th-century railroad hub, offers ample access to the outdoors. The nearly 22,000-acre Browns Canyon National Monument is just outside of town, and a thriving downtown of period buildings filled with restaurants, galleries, and shops near EV charging stations. Mostly what EV drivers need to do to begin the day with a full battery, which can take up to 8 hours, is charge overnight. The Retro Circle R Motel, which starts at $75 a night, provided that with complimentary chargers made from vintage gas pumps. Still, a fully charged battery wouldn't be enough to get me back to Denver, about 170 miles northeast, and return the car with at least a 50% charge as requested. So after an hour of mountain driving, I stopped in Fairplay, a tiny town on a scenic road not considered a byway, and home to a DC fast charging station just a few blocks from a street filled with galleries and restored buildings from its mining heyday. In a diverting hour, I got 60 miles for $20, which is far more than the going rate for gasoline and required I budget time for a stop rather than race directly to the airport. Like everything else with scenic byways and EVs, it pays to take your time. Electrifying America, a charging network owned by Volkswagen and established as part of its 2016 settlement for its diesel emissions scandal, has mapped cross-country driving routes with stations on or close to interstate highways. For leisurely drives that veer away from heavily trafficked corridors, consider the following states. California leads the nation in EV registrations and has nearly 13,000 public charging stations, according to the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. The state's tourism office recommends driving Highway 99, which has regular charging stations, through the agricultural Central Valley, including the wine district of Lodi. The route drive, the ARC, offers charging stations in Northern California from coastal Monterey to Lake Tahoe in the Sierra Nevada range. Oregon has more than 2,200 miles of scenic byways ready for EVs with charging stations spaced every 25 to 50 miles. The Tourism Office offers suggested itineraries on some of these, from the 383-mile-long Pacific Coastal Route beginning in Portland to a day trip from Eugene to some of the state's 50 remaining covered bridges. Among its electrified roads, the state of Washington has chargers posted along its 440-mile Cascade Loop, a route that circles the state and passes through various regions, including the North Cascade Mountains, Lake Chelan Valley, and Bavarian-themed Leavenworth. The Gas and Electricity Company National Grid has identified scenic EV road trips in Massachusetts, New York, and Rhode Island. In New York, it recommends a trip around Lake George in the Adirondack Mountains with a map to 10 charges around town. You may have learned, as I have, that high-tech travel not only comes with a need for planning, but also a need for some extra dollars. Associated Press writer Ben Finley's article, "With the Help of Wealthy Tourist, Titanic Expedition Will Monitor Deterioration," it appeared in the July 4, 2021 Extra Living edition of the News and Observer. The Titanic is disappearing. The iconic ocean liner that was sunk by an iceberg is now slowly succumbing to a metal-eating bacteria. Holes pervade the wreckage, the crow's nest is already gone, and the railing of the ship's iconic bow could collapse at any time. Racing against the inevitable, an undersea exploration company's expedition to the site of the wreckage could start the week of July 4th, beginning what's expected to be an annual chronicling of the ship's deterioration. With the help of wealthy tourists, experts hope to learn more about the vessel, as well as the underwater ecosystem that shipwrecks spawn. The ocean is taking this thing, and we need to document it before it all disappears or becomes unrecognizable, Stockton Rush, president of OceanGate Expeditions, said on July 2nd from a ship headed to the North Atlantic wreck site. The 109-year-old ocean liner is being battered by deep-sea currents and bacteria that consumes hundreds of pounds of iron a day. Some have predicted the ship could vanish in a matter of decades as holes yawn in the hull and sections disintegrate. Since the ship's 1985 discovery, the 100-foot or 30-meter forward mast has collapsed. The crow's nest, from which a lookout shouted, "Iceberg straight ahead," disappeared. And the poop deck, where passengers crowded as the ship sank, folded under itself. The gymnasium near the Grand Staircase has fallen in, and a 2019 expedition discovered that the captain's haunting bathtub, which became visible after the outer wall of the captain's cabin fell away, is gone. At some point, you would expect the railing on the bow, which is very iconic, to have collapsed, Rush said. The company has outfitted its carbon fiber and titanium submersible with high-definition cameras and multi-beam sonar equipment, Rush said. Charting the decomposition can help scientists predict the fate of other deep-sea wrecks, including those that sank during world wars. OceanGate also plans to document the site's sea life, such as crabs and corals. Hundreds of species have only been seen at the wreck, Rush said. Another focus will be the debris field and its artifacts. David Concannon, an OceanGate advisor who's been involved in various Titanic expeditions, said he once followed a trail of light debris and small personal effects like shoes and luggage for 2 kilometers, or about 1.2 miles. The expedition includes archaeologists and marine biologists, but OceanGate is also bringing roughly 40 people who paid to come along. They'll take turns operating sonar equipment and performing other tasks in the 5-person submersible. They're funding the expedition by spending anywhere from $100,000 to $150,000 apiece. Somebody paid $28 million to go with Blue Origin to space, not even the moon, said Renata Rojas, 53, of Hoboken, New Jersey. This is cheap in comparison. Obsessed with the Titanic since she was a kid, Rojas said she started studying oceanography in hopes of one day discovering the wreck, but it was found the same year, prompting her to pursue a career in banking instead. "I kind of need to see it with my own eyes to know that it's really real," she said. Bill Sauter, a Titanic historian who previously managed research for the company that owns the ship's salvage rights, said he doubts the expedition will discover anything that's front-page news, but he said it will improve the world's understanding of the wreck's layout and debris field. For instance, he'd like confirmation regarding where he believes the ship's dog kennels are. OceanGate will not take anything from the site, making this expedition far less controversial than the now-scuttled plans by another firm to retrieve the Titanic's radio. RMS Titanic, the company that owns the wreck salvage rights, wanted to exhibit the radio equipment because it had broadcast the Titanic's distress calls. But the proposal sparked a court battle last year with the U.S. government. It said the expedition would break federal law and a pact with Britain to leave the wreck undisturbed because it's a grave site. All but about 700 of the roughly 2,200 passengers and crew died after the ship struck an iceberg in 1912. The court battle ended after the firm indefinitely delayed its plans because of complications brought on by the coronavirus pandemic. But it's possible that not everyone will approve of this next mission. In 2003, Ed Kamuda, then the president of the Titanic Historical Society, told the Associated Press that human activity, including tourism and expeditions, needs to be limited. He said the site should be a simple maritime memorial and left alone. Let nature take back what is hers, he said. It's only a matter of time before it's a brown stain and a collection of pig iron on the ocean floor. Well, our journey now switches from high-tech exploration to an old-fashioned, perhaps childhood memory destination. In a special to the Washington Post, writer Joanne Cleaver tells us that more vacationers are flocking to treehouses. Her article appeared in the Extra Living edition of the July 4, 2021 issue of the News and Observer. Where there are trees, there is a huge urge to climb them. And once up in the branches, there is the urge to stay there as long as possible. Taking in a bird's-eye view of the landscape and relaxing as the tree rocks over ever so gently in the breeze. While treehouses that let adults sleep close to the stars seem to be having their moment, as Americans craving for wide open spaces coincides with a rise in treehouse accommodations, driven by revenue-seeking vacation property owners. Travelers seeking 360-degree social distancing can consider treehouse rentals across the country in a variety of configurations, such as a rustic room with minimal bath facilities near Virginia's Shenandoah National Park, it's $200 a night, and a high-end suite at Primland Resort in the state's Blue Ridge Mountains, and that's $1,000 a night. Barbara Schroeder, 60, of Salisbury, Maryland, cherishes this memory from an April treehouse day, spending a quiet morning on a deck elevated 15 feet above the forest floor, with steam from coffee curling up through a silent green canopy and a deer wandering through the woods. Schroeder, who loves to include offbeat rentals in her far-flung family's reunion itineraries, rendezvoused with two of her sisters and a niece at one of the three treehouses built by Linda and Dave Klug in their swath of forest in the southeast Ohio Hocking Hills region. Schroeder said that in the 5 days they stayed there, her group never tired of walking from their car's terraced parking spot to the treehouse via a suspension bridge. "We felt like we were stepping out of the world to our own spot," Schroeder said. Listings purporting to be treehouses are growing like kudzu. One of its 100,000 current listings aggregated from numerous national vacation rental services, vacationrenters.com, offers 4,780 properties that include the terms treehouse, one word, or treehouse, two words. Airbnb lists treehouses as the most wish-listed type of rental in its May 2021 Trends report. At Glamping Hub, a booking platform that lists more than 24,000 outdoorsy rentals globally from its base in Spain, 2020 requests for treehouses more than doubled from 2019 and are escalating even faster this year. Glamping Hub's criteria for a treehouse specifies that the accommodation be built in among the branches of trees and is typically reached by a ladder, bridge, or stairway, the company said in an emailed statement. That's not a semantic distinction. Rental platforms rely on property owners to accurately describe their properties, but treehouses have such a strong appeal that some owners use the term treehouse to draw attention to cabins very much on the ground. The bait and switch tangles the count of actual treehouses and irritates travelers and legitimate treehouse owners alike. "I saw several listings that weren't treehouses," Schroeder said. "They were just in a grove of trees." Cabins masquerading as treehouses annoy Victoria Cantwell, who built a rustic complex of rentals in 2017 that includes a bona fide treehouse at her farm in Argyle, New York. Evenings lit with fireflies make the entire experience magical, she said, but she also is losing patience with competitors trying to ride the coattails of the trend. A house on stilts is not a treehouse, said Cantwell. Mine is anchored in two living trees, 15 feet up in the air. They're tricky to build. It's no small task to design and build a genuine adult treehouse that is suitable for overnight stays and complies with building codes, agreed Daniel Ash, head of architecture with Nelson Treehouse in Fall City, Washington. The firm is widely credited with sparking the trend through its Treehouse Masters reality television show, which ran from 2013 to 2018 on Animal Planet. The idiosyncratic requirements for even a single treehouse quickly weed out the wannabes, Ash said. It's the way easier to come up with the idea than to make it happen. A lot of stars have to align to make it a reality. You have to have the right trees for it, the trees have to be able to support the loads, and you have to be feasibly, legally allowed to do this. Every jurisdiction is different. Building a sufficiently feathered nest isn't cheap. A typical treehouse master's project cost about $350,000, Ash said. He estimates that these days about 30% of the firm's projects are for clients who build with intention to rent, up from about 5% 5 years ago. Renting wasn't on Susan Leopold's mind a few years ago. However, when she realized she had a good setup for a grown-up treehouse in her rural Linden, Virginia spread near Shenandoah National Park, building such a house would be a literal expression of Leopold's lifelong commitment to plant preservation. As she says, we have to live in harmony with the trees. Well, there you go. So head to the Shenandoah to look for treehouses, huh? Well, as Joanne Cleaver wrote, some people enjoy a bird's-eye view as part of their travel. Our next article goes kind of way out to prove that point. Alien Real Estate, 1,700 Stars Have Prime Views of the Earth, written by Seth Borenstein of the Associated Press and appeared in the June 24, 2021 extra edition of the News and Observer. Feeling like you're being watched, it could be from a lot farther away than you think, he writes. Astronomers took a technique used to look for life on other planets and flipped it around, so instead of looking to see what's out there, they tried to see what places could see us. There's a lot. Astronomers calculated at 1,715 stars in our galactic neighborhood, and hundreds of probable Earth-like planets circling those stars have had an unobstructed view of Earth during human civilization, according to a study that was printed in the journal Nature in the week of June 23rd. When I look up at the sky, it looks a little bit friendlier because it's like maybe somebody is waving, said study lead author Lisa Kaltenegger, director of the Carl Sagan Institute at Cornell University. Even though some experts, including the late Stephen Hawking, warned against reaching out to aliens because they could harm us, Kaltenberger said it doesn't matter. If those planets have advanced life, someone out there could include that there is life back here, or conclude, rather, that there is life back here based on oxygen in our atmosphere, or by radio waves from human sources that have swept over 75 of the closest stars on her list. So somebody may be watching, so wave. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of this episode of Armchair Traveler. Be sure to listen next time. Hope you enjoyed your journey today. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.